Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Noir on the Radio. I'm your host, Greg Barth, and joining me tonight is our guest author, Rusty Barnes. If you'd like to speak to Rusty at any point during the show, call in. The number to call is 347-633-9609. Once again, that number is 347-633-9609. A little bit about tonight's guest. Rusty Barnes grew up in rural northern Appalachia. He received his BA from Mansfield University of Pennsylvania and his MFA from Emerson College. His fiction, poetry, and nonfiction have appeared in over 200 journals and anthologies. His latest book, a crime novel titled Ridge Runner, hit the streets in May from 280 Steps. A follow-up, The Last Danger, we published in winter of 2017. He is sole proprietor of the blogazine Fried Chicken and Coffee, which focuses on rural and Appalachian concerns, as well as occasional crime fiction. Rusty, welcome to Noir on the Radio. It's great to have you with us this evening.
Oh, it's great to be here. Glad to connect with you finally.
This is very nice. It's good to get to meet you by voice. So I'd like to just say up front, congratulations on Ridge Runner. I thoroughly enjoyed that book.
Great. Thank you. I'm glad you did. It was a lot of fun to write.
Yeah. And, you know, those are the best kind, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
You know, I was as I was thinking about our show tonight, it occurred to me that it was just a little over a year ago that you interviewed me right after my novel Selena came out. And when I think back to that interview, I'm reminded of a couple of things. The first is just how thoughtful your questions were. As a writer, I think you rarely encounter that level of interest in a book during an interview. And the second thing that strikes me when I look back at that was how much I was drinking last year when I answered those questions. I can't promise my questions tonight will be as interesting as yours were, but I can assure you there's no drinking involved.
Okay. Well, so, as long as we got that covered, that's fine.
we're on sober ground. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Rusty, your background, experience, the things that make you the writer that you are today.
Oh, well, I grew up, as you already noted, in rural northern Appalachia and Bradford and Tioga counties in Pennsylvania. And they're really, that part of the country isn't famous for a lot. It came up during, I believe, one of the Clinton years, one of Bill Clinton's years of election. And James Carville said about Pennsylvania, you've got sort of liberals on the Pittsburgh side and liberals on the Philadelphia side. And in the middle, what you've got, unfortunately, politically, is Alabama. So with all the good things that come from that and all the bad things that come from that, you know, it's an area that's been depressed for a number of years. The timber industry and the coal industry both, you know, made their money and left. And, you know, there aren't a lot of companies now outside of the ones that are after the natural gas and the Marcellus Shale. There's really not a lot of opportunity there. And so you end up with a lot of brain drain. You know, when the smart kids grow up and graduate from high school, they go away to college and mostly never come back. And that's a real tragedy. And it's part of the reason I write about the things that I do, you know, wanting to bring to the forefront, you know, the people in that region and how they are and how the stereotypes play against what they're really like.
Yeah, and you have a strong passion for Appalachian and rural fiction, and at least a side interest in crime fiction. What's unique about that geographic area, and you might have already answered that part of it, but just that vein of writing, what draws you to that?
Well, I spent a long time. You figure I sent my first story out for publication in 1988 or 89. And what I was writing at the time was fantasy and science fiction, and it took me actually until I got to graduate school, until I had my MFA in hand to really figure out what I was going to write about. I had a lot of ideas about what I should be writing, but it wasn't necessarily what fed me. And my wife, God bless her, found in a Kmart in Stroudsburg, PA, in the bargain rack, a copy of Larry Brown's book Big Bad Love, and I read that, and that was a sort of transforming event. You know, there were people in there that I could, You know, I didn't necessarily find my people in that book, but I found a people and a place to write about that was my own by comparing what Larry Brown had done for Mississippi and sort of transplanting that idea and those concerns, which sort of fed me into writing about the areas of Pennsylvania that I do.
Yeah, I can definitely understand that. I think even in my own writing, I started off with, you know, horror, fantasy, science fiction, westerns, you name it, and I was never able to really find a voice or make anything work until I, you know, took a stab at crime fiction in a part of the country that I was familiar with. I can completely understand that.
Yeah, you really have to find your people.
You do, yeah. There's a unique drive that comes with you know the sounds, you can hear the voices in your head, you know what the characters are going to say and how they're going to act, and that comes from a genuine place, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about Ridge Runner for a minute. What an excellent page turner Ridge Runner is.
I appreciate that.
I can just picture the movie. Well, it's, you know, I can't say it enough. It's a fantastic book. And if there's anybody listening that, you know, hasn't picked that one up yet, you should right away. I can just picture the movie that needs to be made from Ridge Runner. What?
Your mouth to Hollywood's ears.
There you go. Hopefully they're listening. What led you down the path to that story? Was it a central idea you wanted to explore, a character you wanted to flesh out? What hooked you there?
Well, what had happened was my first novel, Reckoning, which came out in 2014, got a fair amount of attention for even for being in a small press, and it was a story, a coming of age story, really, of a boy going through puberty, really, in Pennsylvania, in the area I grew up, and discovering that the world is a lot more cruel and unforgiving than he thought, and he sort of stumbles into some criminal activity, and I got on the radar of some crime writers that way because of the crime that was central to the story, even though it's really a coming-of-age book. And I thought, okay, you know, maybe I should try this crime fiction and see if I can write something decent. And once I started writing it, it became a real passion that I hadn't even seen before in my writing. I'd always been fairly prolific, but you know, finding my people and finding out that I could write about crime and write about, you know, sort of write about this area in a way that made sense to me. I just wanted to try a crime story and to see how it worked. And, you know, I wrote it and in a pretty short period of time and went through a couple of edits and sent it out. And, you know, it got picked up pretty quickly. So I thought, okay, I'd like to do some more of this. It's harkened back to my years as a teenager reading anything that I could get my hands on, Western science fiction, literary books. And that's where the book came from, really.
Great. You really capture a place in Ridge Runner. I was just amazed at how rich and complex this, you know, this world is. You know, it's a place of hills, mountains, there, you know, trees, gray, barren of leaves in the winter. They're house trailers, dogs, complex family relationships, guns, drugs, poachers, fracking, friends. Is this the rural Pennsylvania that you're describing here? Or, I mean, it just feels like a place that you know intimately.
Well, I do. I have to be honest with you. There wasn't as much crime there as you would imagine from my book, but the further we've gotten into this century, the higher the crime rates have gotten. And in and around, you know, Towanda, Pennsylvania, Towanda, Pennsylvania, the county seat for Bradford County, is actually, that was one of the first places I heard called the meth capital of the world. You can say that about probably six or eight different places now, but you know, there's definitely crime there. There's definitely shady stuff going on in the background. A lot of that's amplified for fiction, of course, but it's still there. I mean, I didn't write about things that aren't happening.
Yeah, and then I think you take in that the rural family ties and just, you know, what family means, and that's an element that you might not see in some of the, you know, urban crime fiction that's out there. I think that's, you know, somewhat unique to the, you know, to the world you're writing about.
Yeah, it's interesting.
So,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you.
No, I was just going to mention that, you know, there are no families that I had in mind while I was reading this, but you can definitely feel that that crime is often a family affair and often something that, you know, runs through generations. You know, the Pittman clan in Ridge Runner is, you know, a family that... I set that family, that crime family, and the things they did against Matt Ryder's family and what he struggles with. And I hope the tension there, you know, provided something that you would get from a good literary novel as well as a good crime novel. You know, I worked fairly hard on making those family relations, you know, the forefront, because crime's never in a vacuum.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I've got a question about that as we progress through to look at that in a little more detail.
Sure.
But we're talking about Ridge Runner, you know, as someone who's read it on my part. But I'm sure there may be listeners who are hearing about this book maybe for the first time or thinking about picking it up. How would you describe Ridge Runner for anyone who's just now learning about it?
Well, I would say that a fairly good descriptor is it's a book with country roots. You know, if you enjoy reading about, you know, rural people dealing with the struggles not only of, you know, being in a crime-ridden area, but also dealing with the struggles of family and how you may try to save the people in your family that you can, but how sometimes, you know, preserving that family's autonomy in the midst of, you know, depression, drug use, illness, you know, what have you. It's, you know, it's a difficult job, and I hope that people would come to it looking not just for crime, but for the story of the characters, you know, the relationships. I think that's what's important about the book.
Absolutely. I would completely agree. Just a reminder to speak to Rusty. The number to call is 347-633-9609. Call at any time during the show, and we'll bring you on to speak live to Rusty. Soldier Pittman, the character who to me feels like the primary antagonist in Ridge Runner. He's off stage for much of the novel, and, you know, to me he had kind of an elusive, you know, ghost-like feel in a lot of ways. It felt, but largely not seen. And aside from Soldier having what I would consider a wonderfully menacing name, what techniques did you use to maintain a sense of threat, you know, from this character throughout the story?
Well, I think when you talk about rural areas, you know, family is a connection that means a great deal to people. You know, my family's large and we have reunions every year, and it's very important to me, it's very important to other members of my family to get together during that time. You know, and I think, you know, showing those family relationships and making sure to balance out the bad and the good was my primary technique. I mean, as far as Soldier being elusive, well, it's sort of like when you look at some horror fiction, you there's a house on the hill that nobody wants to visit, and there's a woman or a man living there that nobody wants to see. A good example of it in a contemporary film would be in Winter's Bone by Daniel Woodrell, which is a great book. There's two families pitted, you know, sort of who are the same. Two families that are related, but sort of separate from each other at the same time. There's a good clan and there's a bad clan, let's say, and it's important to make your characters menacing. I say your antagonists menacing, but, you know, you've got to humanize them at the same time. And the way Woodrell did it was to make those two families, you know, really closely intertwined. You know, sort of this is the side of the family that lives on the hill that you don't necessarily get to talk to, but they still play a part and show their menace throughout, even if they're not on stage.
That's great. So Matt Ryder's family, his brother, Randy, wife, daughter, even his dog, Thump, they all feel the impact of the situation that Matt finds himself in. But these characters, you know, they're textured, they're nuanced. These are not just, you know, characters there to be victimized. While Matt and his brother Randy seem very close, there's a lot of tension between Matt and his wife and also with his daughter. And I think it's rare to see family featured so prominently in this kind of work, but it works so well for this novel. So kind of talk to us about Matt's family, you know, the dog, their role in this story specifically.
Well, there's a dog in almost every one of my stories. I do love dogs. I had a dog when I was a kid, a German Shepherd named Sarge, which is who is Thump's, who was the inspiration for Thump. But anyway, the family is important because, you know, all of what you do in fiction, all the fiction I'm interested in, anyway, comes from character. You know, and I thought to myself, the first image I had for Ridge Runner was of Matt falling into the well. And it was really a question of what ifs after that. You know, what if he couldn't find the people who shot him? What if, you know, he went off the deep end looking for, you know, people that he wouldn't necessarily be able to find, and then drawing the characters around him in opposition to that. You know, his wife is depressed. His daughter's not necessarily the most well-behaved girl that he might have imagined. And all of his decisions, you know, have to be made with those people in mind. And I think the attention to character detail is what has made that portion of the book so strong. At least I hope that's what it is.
I think so. I really do. I mean, it's you know, these feel like real relationships, you know, real people. It's it's extremely well done. You know, during my high school years and later too, even recently, I read a lot of the Louis L'Amour westerns, and you know, some elements of Ridge Runner kind of put me in mind of those stories. In fact, when I finished Ridge Runner, I went out and bought a Louis L'Amour western, just because I kind of felt that. And I'm thinking of, you know, the protagonist being wounded in the first chapter, that strong first person narrative, presence of family, rural setting, you know, those kinds of things. I don't recall any bodies being dismembered in bathtubs with hacksaws in Louis L'Amour stories, but, you know, that's is what it is. But who would you've mentioned Woodrell, you've mentioned Larry Brown. Who would you list as writers that may have had some influence on Ridge Runner?
Well, I don't know that you can. It's interesting that you bring up Louis L'Amour, because I've read, I would say, 90% of everything the man ever wrote. And one of the things I had in mind was the structure of families in his famous series called The Sacketts. He set up three or four different branches of the Sackett family. There was the Flatland Sacketts, and there was the Clinch Mountain Sacketts, and there was the Lowland Sacketts. And each one of them had different characteristics, different ways they behaved. And sometimes they were on the wrong side of the law, and sometimes they weren't. But what he did, what L'Amour did in that, was to make sure that those creations that he made, you know, lived and breathed their family lives. You know, whenever danger shows up, all of the Sacketts show up to fight, not just one. And when I was a kid, I used to think, you know, the people in my family were like that. My father and brother, my uncles, you know, they were all pretty handy, you know. And I always thought, you know, when I was a kid, that you know, someday I would grow up somehow and be forced to reckon with these choices I'd made when I was a kid, and it was kind of disappointing when I got to adulthood and found out that probably wasn't going to happen. Lemoore is certainly one influence. I would say others that mostly literary writers, Harry Cruse, the famous Southern Gothic writer. Hemingway's had a great influence on me, especially his book To Have and Have Not. I don't see Ridge Runner getting written without me having read To Have and Have Not 10 or 12 times. So that's sort of where I'm coming from.
Fascinating. Yeah, I can't imagine the impact that Lemoore has had on, you know, my writing, and Hemingway to me with those, you know, those short sentences and, you know, the lean writing style. I love that. So I want to keep the interview spoiler free for anybody that hasn't read Ridge Runner. So I'm going to ask this in a vague kind of way, but my question is, will we see Matt Ryder again in the near future?
Yes. How's that for an answer? There's a follow-up called The Last Danger, which 280 Steps is going to publish in winter 2017. There's actually another book written after that that we're talking about in terms of edits. So Matt Ryder will definitely be back, although he will be how shall I put this? He's in a compromised state. Let's just put it that way. And that'll pretty much explain the ending of Ridge Runner and, you know, the lead into The Last Danger. He's back, but he's hurting.
I cannot wait. So let's talk a little bit about the craft of writing. You're so well-rounded, you know, being a writer of poetry, short stories, novels, maintaining a website. How do you divide the work? Is it based on your creative mood at the moment, or do you have goals for each format that you work toward?
The only goals I really have is that I've wanted to publish a book of poetry, a book of fiction, a collection of fiction, a novel, and a collection of essays and a memoir. You know, I'd like to do all of those things, and I'm about halfway there. But I'm sorry. Remind me of what you were asking.
Yeah. So how do you divide your work as far as poetry, short stories, novels? Yeah. Do you write? You know, do you have a regular schedule, a goal that you hit each day, or is it just kind of the mood that you're in?
Oh no, I have a definite schedule. When I'm writing, which I'm in a period where I'm not writing now, but when I'm writing, I write for about an hour and a half every day, and I have a goal of 1,000 words. If I'm writing prose, if I'm writing poetry, I like to and hope to have a draft of something at the end of that hour and a half. So that's really as much as I do and as much as I think about it. You know, if an essay idea strikes, then I'll drop what I'm doing and work that until I finish that and come back to a novel or short stories or poems, whatever I happen to be working on at the time. I tend to go in streaks. April is National Poetry Writing Month, and I always end up writing a lot of poems during that time. But most of the time I'm hunkered down writing a novella or a novel.
Excellent, yeah. So just a reminder that Noir on the Radio is a trademarked and copyrighted podcast solely owned by Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. To call in and speak to Rusty tonight, the number is 347-633-9609. Call in at any time. So can you tell us about your writing process? You mentioned a word count, 1,000 words. How do you keep that going day in and day out? Do you write every day, not every day? What's your process there?
When I'm on a novel or a novella, I'm writing every day. With poems, that really, they come with inspiration. But novels are the place where I feel like the majority of my talent lies. You know, I want to be working on novellas and novels. Now that I've discovered the short crime novel, the book that runs between, let's say, 37,000 and 55,000 words seems to be my sweet spot. And I like writing at that length, and I've had good luck publishing at that length in the small press, so I'll likely continue doing that.
you know, in a lot of ways that just feels like the right length for these kinds of stories. At least it does to me. For me, I'm finding the last couple of things I've written, and they're not published yet, but they're complete from a writing standpoint, come in about, you know, 45,000-46,000 words, and that just, you know, feels like the right arc for this type of story. You know, typically something told from a first person perspective, so you don't have the complexity of multiple point of views, and you know, it's, you just you take them through that one story arc, big finish, and then, you know, then move on to the next. It seems to be a kind of a golden age for the crime novella or short novel, I feel, at this point.
Oh, I do too. Absolutely. I'm happy to be writing them. Pleased as punch, as you might say. But there's always been the short novel and the novella. Particularly, you know, the French have written a lot of short novels. You know, Simenon, who I've been reading lately, wrote a number of short books that come in that sweet spot between 140 to 180 pages, and that's roughly, you know, what we're talking about here with crime novellas. You know, there's a lot to be said for something you can read in one sitting.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's this good and satisfying short read. I kind of liken it to a 90-minute crime movie. It feels, with a little more complexity and texture, and, you know, you feel it a little more because it's a book. What advice would you offer an aspiring novelist?
There's only one rule, really. It's the rule that Harry Cruse had posted over his typewriter. Lots of people have these rules, but his was simple: put your ass in the chair. It took me till I was 40 years old to figure out that was what I needed to do, and I've had great success publishing and writing since I turned 40. For whatever reason, I just didn't sit down enough in my 20s and 30s to write as well as I should have, and now I'm doing what feels like my important work, the things that I was meant to write, and I regret those, you know, those 20s and 30s to a certain extent, because I, you know, there's a lot of wasted time there. But yeah, you just need to sit down and do it. That's, you know, my daughter's a writer as well. She's 18, and the thing that I tell her to calm her down when she's telling me about all the ideas she has, you know, is, well, you know, honey, you got to sit down, you got to do it. You know, it's one thing to talk about a book, but you can talk a book to death. You need to put your ass in the chair. That's the only rule.
Amen. Well said. What would you say, Rusty, is the worst piece of advice you've been given about writing?
Write what you know. Even though that I ended up writing what I know, that it's really bad advice, because you tend in your life to, if you tend in your life to write about the things that are concerning you in your 20s and 30s, maybe you're not going to be writing such interesting stuff. You know, I don't know how many novels I've read about college kids, but I've read enough of them to know that I don't want to do it again. And even, you know, people going through sort of sordid love affairs in their 30s and 40s, you know, the academic novel, which you see a lot in MFA programs, you know, students having affairs with professors, you know, it's not really what I'm interested in. And I think you've got to live at least to a certain extent in those 20s and 30s to find the good stuff to write about. And it's not necessarily going to be what you know at that point.
Couldn't agree with you more. I think I was telling somebody, Mike Monson from All Due Respect Books, he had something on there about write what you know on, and he had this on Facebook. And I think I mentioned that I wrote about a young female prostitute who couldn't get her car started one night and was beaten as a result and went out seeking revenge. And if there's one thing I know, it's the frustration of not being able to start your car. So, yep, I couldn't agree more. So, as you know, I consider writers to be entertainers.
Mm-hmm.
And as an entertainer yourself, I'm curious about what kinds of things entertain you. What are you reading these days, watching, listening to? What keeps your creative juices flowing?
Well, reading is what does it for me. I'm actually where I'm sitting right now is in my newly alphabetized library. My son and my wife and I finally went through and alphabetized, you know, what I have left of my books. So I'm sitting here among 2,000 books, and I've got another 500 or 600 probably on my Kindle. But that's what I do. I don't really have any hobbies. I play guitar badly. I watch some sports on TV. But I read and I write, and what I'm reading right now is actually sort of an offshoot from the Louis L'Amour we were talking about earlier. I went in search of books that I really loved when I was a kid, and I found this series of books by a writer, John Benteen, which was a pseudonym for a writer named Ben Haas, and he wrote 14 or 15 of these westerns about a man named Jim Sundance, who was a half-breed Indian who kicked a lot of ass, basically. And I went back to those and bought a couple of them from Piccadilly Publishing, which, if you ever want to lose some time, go to Piccadilly Publishing, take a look at what they do. They reprint classic westerns and some non-classic westerns from the 70s and 80s, and I found the whole series of Sundance books, which, as I said, I loved when I was a kid, and I love reading them now. And they're not necessarily holding up as well writing-wise, but I remember how excited I was to read them and how excited I was to get the next one. And I hope to do that with the books I'm writing now. I hope that someone's reading them and going, hey, you know, I really would like to, I would really like to get on to the, you know, to this next book. You know, I'd like Matt Ryder to continue as a series. I'm not sure I can physically do it because I'm not sure I have enough original ideas, but that's what I love about writing. You know, I've got this Jones now to keep going with Matt Ryder and see if I can carry him out to a 15 or 16 book series, you know, or go on as long as someone like James Lee Burke, his Dave Robichaux novels, which I admire a great deal. You know, I would love to be able to do that and to have a career like that.
Well, I can't wait to see what comes next for Matt Ryder. And I, too, hope that we see many more volumes in his adventures to come. And I was just furiously jotting down notes about the Piccadilly Publishing, John Benteen and Jim Sundance, because I want to check those out, too.
They're worth your time.
Where can... I fully believe it. I remember those Sundance novels, you know, from way back, and I don't know that I ever read any, but it looked. I just remember from the exciting covers, it looked like something. It stands out in my memory seeing those, so I'm definitely going to check that out.
Good.
So, where can everybody find you and keep up with you out there on the web, Rusty?
Well, the easiest thing to do would be to go to my website at rustybarnes.com, or you can hit me up on Facebook. I'm always ready and willing to talk writing or to talk about anything, you know, on Facebook. And you can find me there at facebook.com/rustybarnes23. That's my author page. And find me there or find me in the regular Facebooks, you know, and hit me up. And that's where all of my publishing news goes first.
Thank you. And what's up and coming that we can expect next from Rusty Barnes?
Well, I've got that book coming out from 280 Steps in winter 2017. I've got another one that's going to be coming out roughly the same time, which is a novel and stories about a Croatian hitman and enforcer named Kraj, K-R-A-J. And those stories right now are just collected under the name Kraj the Enforcer. Hopefully I'll have a snappier title when they come out, but that's where it stands right now, and that'll be out in 2017. And I've got two other novellas in the can just waiting for me to edit and to get out there in the world. One of them is called Knuckle Dragger, which is the first book I've ever set outside of Pennsylvania. It actually takes place in the area I live in, Revere, Massachusetts, and I hope to find a publisher for that one really soon. I'm really proud of that one. I'm stepping out of my comfort zone for the first time. So that's what you can expect right now.
That's great to hear. I'll definitely keep my eyes peeled for sure. So Rusty, I'd like to ask you to maybe share a brief reading of something that you would like to share with the audience of your writing you know, your choice. What would you like to read for us tonight?
I'm actually going to read a piece called "Let the Girl Do It," which just appeared in Out of the Gutter's website, Flash Fiction Offensive. So it's a real short piece, and that's what I'm going to read. So it's called, again, "Let the Girl Do It." "I just need to know what you did with Terrence's money box," Jessica said to Hank. Terrence had been one of her boyfriends up until 23 hours ago when she'd found him slumped in the shower with a bullet hole in his head. Someone matching Hank's description had been seen leaving the house. Jess's neighbor had offered up the information willingly as Jessica had produced tears on the spot. The neighbors didn't know what really went on inside Terrence and Jessica's house. Donald, though, another boyfriend, knew what went on. Jessica took a 20-penny spike and drove it through the palm of Hank's left hand and into the table with three sharp blows. It took the spread of the blood across the table like an ink blot for him to acknowledge it. He spat at her through bloody, chewed lips. "This ain't my first rodeo," he said, rattling the cuff she'd attached between his right arm and the chair. "Oh, I know it," Jessica said, putting down the hammer and picking up her Glock. "That's why I have Donald here." Donald rapped Hank on the side of his head with his .357. "I'm still here, motherfucker," Donald said, but Jessica could see Donald's hand trembling. She hoped he could still do what needed to be done. "This is amateur hour," Hank said. "You're not getting anything from me." Jessica considered her options. "Take your pants down," Jessica said. "Fuck you," Hank said. Donald hit Hank harder this time, a bloody crease appearing on his upper cheek. "Watch your mouth," Donald said, his hand trembling. "I'm going to attach your penis to the chair," Jessica said. "Bullshit," Hank said. "You want to bet me, big man?" Jessica holstered the Glock under her arm and picked up another short spike. With a practiced motion, she set the spike to his right eye and drove it home. Blood and fluid burst forth like a split fruit. "Oh, Jesus. Jesus, fuck," Hank said. Blood ran down his cheek. Jessica felt like licking it. "Take your pants down, Hank. Donald, help him." "The box is in the back of my wife's Prius," Hank said. "Easy enough," Jessica said. She patted Hank's head like a dog, then shot him in the face. The body slumped to the floor at an odd angle, held up by his spiked hand. More red pulsed from his hand momentarily. "Jesus," Donald said, wiping his mouth. "The least you could do is not puke on me," Jessica said. "It would be a short trip to get the money now," assuming Hank had told the truth. But she knew he had. It was the last thing she saw in his good eye. And that's the end.
There you have it, folks. Rusty Barnes sharing his own piece of fiction. It doesn't get much better than that. So, Rusty, thank you so much for joining us
on
the radio this evening.
I had a great time.
It was a pleasure to get to chat, and we'll have you back on, you know, as soon as we can. This was great.
All right, thanks a lot.
And to the listeners, thank you. And to the listeners, you know, I encourage you to check out Rusty Barnes novels. They're available just a mouse click away. Pick up Ridge Runner, you won't be sorry. So this is Greg Barth, your host, wishing you a great night of noir reading. Until next time.